Chapter 12. No one can say on seeing a fighting bull in the corrals whether that bull will be brave in the ring, although usually the quieter the bull is, the less nervous he seems, the calmer he is, the more chance that he will turn out brave. The reason for this is that the braver he is, usually the more confident he is and the less he bluffs. All supposed exterior signs of danger that a bull gives, such as pawing the ground, threatening with his horns, or bellowing, are forms of bluffing. They are warnings given in order that combat may be avoided if possible. The truly brave bull gives no warning before he charges except the fixing of his eye on his enemy, the raising of the crest of muscle in his neck, the twitching of an ear, and as he charges, the lifting of his tail. A completely brave bull, if he is in perfect condition, will never open his mouth, will not even let his tongue out during the course of the entire fight, and at the finish with the sword in him will come toward the man while his legs support him, with his mouth tight shut to keep the blood in. Now, what makes a bull brave is first, the strain of fighting blood which can only be kept pure by conscientious testing in the tientas, and second, his own health and condition. Health and condition will not replace scrupulous breeding, but lack of them will ruin the natural inherited bravery of an animal, will make his body incapable of responding to it, or else cause the bravery to burn up as a fire of straw, burning out in a single flare, and the bull being then empty and hollow. Health and condition are determined, granting there has been no disease on the ranch, by pasture and water. It is the differences of pasture and water in different parts of Spain, caused by the different climates, the changes in composition of the soil, and the distances the stock must go to water from their pastures, that make entirely different types of bull. Spain is more a continent than a country in regard to climates. For the climate and vegetation of the north, of Navarra, for example, has nothing in common with that of Valencia or Andalusia, and none of those three, except parts of Navarra, have any resemblance to the high plateau of Castilla. So the bulls raised in Navarra, Andalusia, and Salamanca differ greatly, and this is not due to them coming from differing strains. Navarrese bulls are almost a different race, smaller and usually of a reddish color, but when bull raisers in Navarra have taken seed bulls and cows from an Andalusian ranch and try to transplant them to Navarra, they have invariably taken on the present vices of the northern bulls, nervousness, uncertainty in attack, and lack of true bravery, and have lost their original character without gaining any of the quickness, courage, and deer-like speed that characterized the old strains of Navarra. Bulls in Navarra are about bred out due to inbreeding of the original Navarrese strain and the selling of their best cows to France a number of years ago for use in the curse Landaise, a French form of bullfet, and the inability of the Andalusian and Castilian strains to retain their type and bravery on the northern ranges, although many costly experiments have been made to develop a new and brave Navarrese strain. The best fighting bulls come from Andalusia, Colmena, Salamanca, and exceptionally, Portugal. The most typical bulls are those of Andalusia. The Andalusian breeds have been taken to Salamanca and perverted by breeding them down in size and in length of horn in order to please the bullfighters. Salamanca is an ideal province for bull breeding. The pastures and water are good, and the bulls from there are sold at under 4 years and often, to make them appear larger and older, are fed on grain for a time, which gives them a false size, covering the natural muscle with fat, giving them a false well-being, causing them to tire quickly and to be short of wind. Many bulls from Salamanca, if fought at 4.5 to 5 years, hence having their natural size and not needing to be fed up on grain to reach the government-required poundage, with a year more on the range and the consequent added maturity, would be the ideal fighting bulls, except for a tendency that they have to lose frankness and bravery when they have passed their 4th year. Occasionally you will see such a corrida in Madrid, but on the publicity they receive from such a splendid lot of bulls, and with the aid and connivances of the bullfighters, the same breeders that send such an ideal corrida to the capital will sell 15 or 20 other corridas throughout the provinces in a season which will be composed of bulls under the minimum age, stuffed on grain to make them seem big, giving the minimum of danger because of their lack of experience in using their horns, and helping in every way by depriving the spectacle of that which makes it, the true fighting bull, to contribute to the decadence of bullfighting. For the third factor in the making of a bull after breeding and condition is age. With any one of these three factors lacking, you cannot have a complete fighting bull. A bull is not mature until after his fourth year. It is true that after his third year he looks mature, but he is not. Maturity brings strength, resistance, but above all, knowledge. Now, the knowledge of a bull consists principally in his memory of experience, he forgets nothing, and in his knowledge of and ability to use his horns. It is the horn that makes bullfighting, and the ideal bull is one whose memory is as clean as possible from any experience of bullfighting so that he will learn everything that he is to learn in the ring, being dominated if the bullfighter works improperly, and dominating the bullfighter if his work is deficient or cowardly. And for this bull to provide the most real danger and put the bullfighter to the necessary test of knowledge of how to handle a bull properly, he must know how to use his horns. At 4 years, a bull has this knowledge. He has acquired it by fighting on the range, the only way he can acquire it. To see two bulls fight is a beautiful sight. They use their horns as a fencer does his weapon. They strike, parry, feint, block, and have an exactitude of aim that is amazing. When they both know how to use the horn, the combat usually ends as does a fight between two really skillful boxers, with all dangerous blows stopped, without bloodshed, and with mutual respect. They do not have to kill each other for a decision. The bull that loses is the first one that breaks and turns, acknowledging the other's superiority. I have seen them fight again and again for small causes that I was not able to make out, coming head-on, feinting with their master horn, the horns clattering as they knocked together, the blows being parried and countered, then suddenly one bull would wheel and turn and gallop off. Once, though, in the corrals, after a fight in which one bull turned away, admitting he was beaten, the other followed him and charged, getting the horn in the defeated bull's flank and throwing him over. Before the bull that was down could get to his feet, the other was on him, driving the horn in with chopping thrusts of his neck and head, driving in all the time. The defeated bull got to his feet once, wheeled to face head on, but in the first horn exchange he was caught in the eye, then went down under another charge. The bull killed him without letting him get to his feet again. Before the fight 2 days later, that same bull killed another in the corrals. But when he came into the ring, he was one of the best animals, both for bullfighters and public, that I have ever seen. His horn knowledge had been acquired as it should be. He had no vices with the horn, he simply knew how to use it, and the matador, Felix Rodriguez, dominated him, did splendid work with the cape and muleta, and killed him perfectly. A 3-year-old bull may know how to use his horns, but it is exceptional. He has not had enough experience. Bulls over 5 years know too well how to use their armament. They have had so much experience and become so skilled with the horn that the necessity for overcoming and watching out for this makes it almost impossible for the bullfighter to do anything brilliant. They make an interesting fight, but you need a thorough knowledge of bullfighting to appreciate the matador's work. Nearly every bull has one horn that he prefers to use more than the other, and this horn is called the master horn. They are often almost as right or left-horned as people are right or left-handed, but there is no such preponderance in favor of the right horn. One is as liable to be the master as the other. You may see which horn is the master when the banderilleros run the bull with the cape at the start of the fight, but there is another way you can often tell. A bull, when he is about to charge or when he is angry, twitches one or occasionally both ears. The ear that he twitches is usually on the side of the horn that he uses for preference. Bulls vary greatly in the way they use their horns. Some are called assassins from the way in which, attacking the picadors, they will not give a single chop until they are sure of their range. Then, when they are close, driving the horn into the vulnerable part of the horse with the surety of a dagger stroke. Such bulls have usually attacked a herder or killed a horse previously at some time on the range, and they remember how it is done. They do not charge from a distance and try to overthrow horse and man, but only to get in under the picador in some way, often chopping at the shaft of the pole with their horn so they can place their horn stroke. For this reason, the number of horses killed by a bull may not be an indication of his bravery nor of his power, for a bull with a deadly horn will kill horses where a braver, more powerful bull will, perhaps, only overthrow horse and rider, and in his violence aim scarcely at all with the horn. A bull that has gored a man becomes much more liable to gore again. A great part of the matadors who have been gored and killed in the ring have been caught and tossed previously by the bull that finally killed them. Of course, many times this repetition of the goring in the course of the same fight is due to the man being shocked into grogginess or deprived of his agility or judgment of distance by the first tossing. But it is also true that a bull which has found the man under the lure or after the placing of a pair of banderillas will repeat the process by which he caught him. He will give a sudden chop with his head as he passes the man while following the cape or muleta, or a breaking with his feet in the center of the charge, or a swerving from the cloth toward the man with his horn, or whatever act it was which caught the man the first time. Similarly, there are certain strains even of bulls in which the ability to learn rapidly in the ring is highly developed. These bulls must be fought and killed as rapidly as possible with the minimum of exposure by the man, for they learn more rapidly than the fight ordinarily progresses and become exaggeratedly difficult to work with and kill. Bulls of this sort are the old caste of fighting bulls raised by the sons of Don Eduardo Miura of Sevilla. Although the sons of that most scrupulous bull breeder have tried to make their bulls less dangerous and more acceptable to the bullfighters by crossbreeding with bulls of the Vista Hermosa strain, the noblest, bravest, and most candid of all the strains, and have succeeded in turning out bulls that have the imposing size, horns, and all the other appearance of the old deadly Miuras without their ferocious and crescent intelligence which made them the curse of all bullfighters. There is a breed of bulls which have the old Miura cast, blood, stature, power, and fierceness that are raised in Portugal by Don José Palha, and if you ever see a bullfight with them advertised, you will see what bulls can be at their fiercest, most powerful, and most dangerous. They say that the Palha range where the mature bulls pasture is 12 kilometers from the water. I do not vouch for this, and that the bulls develop their great strength, wind, and staying power by having to go so far for water. This was told me by a cousin of Palha, but I have never checked up on it. As certain strains of fighting bulls will be particularly stupid and brave, and others intelligent and brave, others will have different characteristics which are highly individual and yet will persist in most of the bulls of that breed. The bulls formerly bred and owned by the Duke of Baragua were examples of this. They were, at the beginning of this century and for years after, among the bravest, strongest, fastest, and finest looking of all the bulls of the peninsula. But what were only minor tendencies 20 years earlier finally came to be the dominant characteristics of the whole strain. When they were nearly perfect bulls, one of their first characteristics was a great rush of speed in the first third of the fight, which left the bull rather winded and logy at the end. Another characteristic was that once a Baragua had caught and gored a man or horse, he would not leave him but would attack again and again, seeming to want to destroy his victim entirely. But they were very brave, willing to charge, and followed cape and muleta well. In 20 years, there was almost nothing left of the original good qualities except the first speed in charging, while the tendency to become heavy and leaden as the fight went on was so exaggerated that a Baragua bull was almost dead on its feet after the first contact with the picadors. The tendency to keep on after a victim persisted, greatly exaggerated, but the speed, strength, and bravery were all decreased to the minimum. In this way, great strains of bulls will decrease in value for fighting in spite of the care and scruples of the breeder. He will try crossing with other strains, the only remedy, and sometimes these will be successful and there will be a new good strain, but more often they will cause the breed to disintegrate even more rapidly and lose whatever good characteristics it had. An unscrupulous bull breeder can buy the bulls of a good breed, and by profiting by their reputation for good presentation and bravery, and himself selling everything with horns that is not a cow as a bull, destroy the good name of the breed and make a certain amount of money in a few years. He will not destroy the value of the breed as long as the blood remains good and the bulls have pasture and water that are good for them. A scrupulous breeder can take the same bulls, and by testing them carefully and selling only those for fights which show bravery, re-establish the breed in a short time. But when the blood that made the reputation of a breed goes thin, and defects that were only minor characteristics become dominant, then a breed, except for the occasional good bull that will be produced as an exception, is finished unless revived by a lucky and dangerous cross. I saw the last of the good bulls, the fast decay and the finish of the Baragua breed, and it was sad to watch. The present Duke sold them finally, and the new owners are trying to revive the strain again. Half-breed bulls, or bulls in which there is a little fighting bull blood, called moruchos in Spanish, are often very brave wild calves, showing the best characteristics of fighting stock. But as they reach maturity, they lose all bravery and style and are altogether unfit for the ring. This falling off in bravery and style on complete maturity is characteristic of all bulls in which the fighting strain is mixed with ordinary blood and is the principal difficulty the Salamanca breeders face. There it is not the result of half-caste breeding, but is rather a characteristic seemingly inherent in bulls bred and pastured in that country. As a result, if the Salamanca breeder wishes his bulls to come out with the maximum of bravery, he must sell them young. These immature bulls have done more harm to bullfighting in every way than almost any other influence. The main strains from which most of the best of the present-day breeds of bulls come, directly or through various crossings, are those of Vasquez, Cabrera, Vista Hermosa, Saavedra, Lesaca, and Ibarra. The breeders who furnish the best bulls today are the sons of Pablo Romero of Sevilla, the Conde de Santa Coloma of Madrid, Conde de la Corte of Badajoz, Doña Concepción de la Concha y Sierra of Sevilla, daughter of the famous widow of Concha y Sierra, Doña Carmen de Federico of Madrid, present owner of the Merube breed, the sons of Don Eduardo Miura of Sevilla, Marques de Villamarta of Sevilla, Don Argimiro Pérez Tabernero, Don Gracialano Pérez Tabernero, and Don Antonio Pérez Tabernero, all of Salamanca. Don Francisco Sánchez of Coquilla in the province of Salamanca, Don Florentino Sotomayor of Córdoba, Don José Pereira Palha of Villafranca de Zifra, Portugal, the widow of Don Félix Gómez of Colmenar Viejo, Doña Enriqueta de la Cova of Sevilla, Don Félix Moreno Ardanui of Sevilla, Marqués de Albaida of Madrid, and Don Julian Fernández Martínez of Colmenar Viejo, who owns the old breed of Don Vicente Martínez. There is not a word of conversation in the chapter, madam, yet we have reached the end. I'm very sorry.
No sorrier than I am, sir.
What would you like to have? More major truths about the passions of the race? A diatribe against venereal disease? A few bright thoughts on death and dissolution? Or would you care to hear the author's experience with a porcupine during his earliest years spent in Emmett and Charlevoix counties in the state of Michigan?
Please, sir, no more about animals today.
What do you say to one of those homilies on life and death that delight an author so to write?
I cannot truly say I want that either. Have you not something of a sort I've never read, amusing yet instructive? I do not feel my best today.
Madam, I have the very thing you need. It's not about wild animals nor bulls. It's written in popular style and is designed to be the Whittier's Snowbound of our time, and at the end it's simply full of conversation.
If it has conversation in it, I would like to read it.
Do so then. It's called A Natural History of the Dead. Old Lady:
I don't care for the title.
Author: I didn't say you would. You may very well not like any of it, but here it is. A Natural History of the Dead. It has always seemed to me that the war has been omitted as a field for the observations of the naturalist. We have charming and sound accounts of the flora and fauna of Patagonia by the late W. H. Hudson. The Reverend Gilbert White has written most interestingly of the hoopoe on its occasional and not at all common visits to Selborne, and Bishop Stanley has given us a valuable, although popular, familiar history of birds. Can we not hope to furnish the reader with a few rational and interesting facts about the dead? I hope so. When that persevering traveler, Mungo Park, was at one period of his course, fainting in the vast wilderness of an African desert, naked and alone, considering his days as numbered, and nothing appeared to remain for him to do but to lie down and die, a small moss flower of extraordinary beauty caught his eye. "Though the whole plant," says he, "was no larger than one of my fingers, I could not contemplate the delicate conformation of its roots, leaves, and capsules without admiration. Can that being who planted, watered, and brought to perfection in this obscure part of the world a thing which appears of so small importance look with unconcern upon the situation and suffering of creatures formed after his own image? Surely not. Reflections like these would not allow me to despair. I started up, and disregarding both hunger and fatigue, traveled forward. Assured that relief was at hand, and I was not disappointed." With a disposition to wonder and adore in like manner, as Bishop Stanley says, can no branch of natural history be studied without increasing that faith, love, and hope, which we also, every one of us, need in our journey through the wilderness of life. Let us therefore see what inspiration we may derive from the dead. In war, the dead are usually the male of the human species, although this does not hold true with animals, and I have frequently seen dead mares among the horses. An interesting aspect of war, too, is that it is only there that the naturalist has an opportunity to observe the dead of mules. In 20 years of observation in civil life, I had never seen a dead mule, and had begun to entertain doubts as to whether these animals were really mortal. On rare occasions I had seen what I took to be dead mules, but on close approach these always proved to be living creatures who seemed to be dead through their quality of complete repose. But in war these animals succumb in much the same manner as the more common and less hardy horse. Old Lady: I thought you said it wasn't about animals. Author: It won't be for long. Be patient, can't you? It's very hard to write like this. Most of the mules that I saw dead were along mountain roads or lying at the foot of steep declivities whence they had been pushed to rid the road of their encumbrance. They seemed a fitting enough sight in the mountains, where one was accustomed to their presence, and looked less incongruous there than they did later at Smyrna, where the Greeks broke the legs of all their baggage animals and pushed them off the quay into the shallow water to drown. The numbers of broken-legged mules and horses drowning in the shallow water called for a Goya to depict them. Although, speaking literally, one can hardly say that they called for a Goya, since there has been only one Goya, long dead, and it is extremely doubtful if these animals, were they able to call, would call for pictorial representation of their plight, but more likely would, if they were articulate, call for someone to alleviate their condition. Old Lady: You wrote about those mules before. Author: I know it, and I'm sorry. Stop interrupting. I won't write about them again, I promise. Regarding the sex of the dead, it is a fact that one becomes so accustomed to the sight of all the dead being men that the sight of a dead woman is quite shocking. I first saw inversion of the usual sex of the dead after the explosion of a munition factory which had been situated in the countryside near Milan, Italy. We drove to the scene of the disaster in trucks along poplar-shaded roads, bordered with ditches containing much minute animal life, which I could not clearly observe because of the great clouds of dust raised by the trucks. Arriving where the munition plant had been, some of us were put to patrolling about those large stocks of munitions which, for some reason, had not exploded, while others were put at extinguishing a fire which had gotten into the grass of an adjacent field, which task being concluded, we were ordered to search the immediate vicinity and surrounding fields for bodies. We found and carried to an improvised mortuary a good number of these, and I must admit, frankly, the shock it was to find that these dead were women rather than men. In those days, women had not yet commenced to wear their hair cut short, as they did later for several years in Europe and America. And the most disturbing thing, perhaps because it was the most unaccustomed, was the presence, and even more disturbing, the occasional absence of this long hair. I remember that after we had searched quite thoroughly for the complete dead, we collected fragments. Many of these were detached from a heavy barbed wire fence which had surrounded the position of the factory, and from the still existent portions of which we picked many of these detached bits, which illustrated only too well the tremendous energy of high explosive. Many fragments we found a considerable distance away in the fields, they being carried farther by their own weight. On our return to Milan, I recall one or two of us discussing the occurrence and agreeing that the quality of unreality and the fact that there were no wounded did much to rob the disaster of a horror which might have been much greater. Also, the fact that it had been so immediate and that the dead were in consequence still as little unpleasant as possible to carry and deal with made it quite removed from the usual battlefield experience. The pleasant, though dusty, ride through the beautiful Lombard countryside also was a compensation for the unpleasantness of the duty, and on our return, while we exchanged impressions, we all agreed that it was indeed fortunate that the fire which broke out just before we arrived had been brought under control as rapidly as it had, and before it had attained any of the seemingly huge stocks of unexploded munitions. We agreed, too, that the picking up of the fragments had been an extraordinary business, it being amazing that the human body should be blown into pieces which exploded along no anatomical lines, but rather divided as capriciously as the fragmentation in the burst of a high explosive shell. Old lady, this is not amusing. Author, stop reading it then. Nobody makes you read it. But please stop interrupting. A naturalist, to obtain accuracy of observation, may confine himself in his observations to one limited period, and I will take first that following the Austrian offensive of June 1918 in Italy, as one in which the dead were present in their greatest numbers, a withdrawal having been forced and an advance later made to recover the ground lost, so that the positions after the battle were the same as before, except for the presence of the dead. Until the dead are buried, they change somewhat in appearance each day. The color change in Caucasian races is from white to yellow-green, to black. If left long enough in the heat, the flesh comes to resemble coal tar, especially where it has been broken or torn, and it has quite a visible tar-like iridescence. The dead grow larger each day until sometimes they become quite too big for their uniforms, filling these until they seem blown tight enough to burst. The individual members may increase in girth to an unbelievable extent, and faces fill as taut and globular as balloons. The surprising thing next to their progressive corpulence is the amount of paper that is scattered about the dead. Their ultimate position, before there is any question of burial, depends on the location of the pockets in the uniform. In the Austrian army, these pockets were in the back of the breeches, and the dead, after a short time, all consequently lay on their faces, the two hip pockets pulled out and scattered around them in the grass, all those papers their pockets had contained. The heat, the flies, the indicative positions of the bodies in the grass, and the amount of papers scattered are the impressions one retains. The smell of a battlefield in hot weather one cannot recall. You can remember that there was such a smell, but nothing ever happens to you to bring it back. It is unlike the smell of a regiment, which may come to you suddenly while riding in the streetcar, and you will look across and see the man who has brought it to you. But the other thing is gone as completely as when you have been in love. You remember things that happened, but the sensation cannot be recalled. Old lady, I like it whenever you write about love. Author, thank you, madam. One wonders what that persevering traveler Mungo Park would have seen on a battlefield in hot weather to restore his confidence. There were always poppies in the wheat in the end of June and in July, and the mulberry trees were in full leaf, and one could see the heat waves rise from the barrels of the guns where the sun struck them through the screens of leaves. The earth was turned a bright yellow at the edge of holes where mustard gas shells had been, and the average broken house is finer to see than one that has never been shelled. But few travelers would take a good full breath of that early summer air and have any such thoughts as Mungo Park about those formed in his own image. The first thing that you found about the dead was that, hit badly enough, they died like animals. Some quickly from a little wound you would not think would kill a rabbit. They died from little wounds as rabbits die sometimes, from three or four small grains of shot that hardly seemed to break the skin. Others would die like cats, a skull broken in and iron in the brain. They lie alive 2 days like cats that crawl into the coal bin with a bullet in the brain and will not die until you cut their heads off. Maybe cats do not die then. They say they have 9 lives. I do not know. But most men die like animals, not men. I'd never seen a natural death, so-called, and so I blamed it on the war, and like the persevering traveler Mungo Park, knew that there was something else, that always absent something else, and then I saw one. The only natural death I've ever seen, outside of loss of blood, which isn't bad, was death from Spanish influenza. In this, you drown in mucus, choking, and how you know the patient's dead is, at the end, he shits the bed full. So now I want to see the death of any self-called humanist, because a persevering traveler like Mungo Park or me lives on, and maybe yet will live to see the actual death of members of this literary sect and watch the noble exits that they make. In my musings as a naturalist, it has occurred to me that while decorum is an excellent thing, some must be indecorous if the race is to be carried on, since the position prescribed for procreation is indecorous, highly indecorous, and it occurred to me that perhaps that is what these people are, or were, the children of decorous cohabitation. But regardless of how they started, I hope to see the finish of a few and speculate how worms will try that long-preserved sterility. With their quaint pamphlets gone to bust, and into footnotes all their lust. Old lady, that's a very nice line about lust. Author, I know it. It came from Andrew Marvel. I learned how to do that by reading T.S. Eliot. Old lady, the Eliots were all old friends of our family. I believe they were in the lumber business. Author, my uncle married a girl whose father was in the lumber business. Old lady, how interesting. While it is perhaps legitimate to deal with these self-designated citizens in a natural history of the dead, even though the designation may mean nothing by the time this work is published, yet it is unfair to the other dead, who were not dead in their youth of choice, who owned no magazines, many of whom had doubtless never even read a review, that one is seen in the hot weather with a half pint of maggots working where their mouths have been. It was not always hot weather for the dead. Much of the time it was the rain that washed them clean when they lay in it and made the earth soft when they were buried in it, and sometimes then kept on until the earth was mud and washed them out and you had to bury them again. Or in the winter in the mountains you had to put them in the snow, and when the snow melted in the spring someone else had to bury them. They had beautiful burying grounds in the mountains. War in the mountains is the most beautiful of all war, and in one of them, at a place called Poco, they buried a general who was shot through the head by a sniper. This is where those writers are mistaken who write books called Generals Die in Bed, because this general died in a trench dug in snow high in the mountains, wearing an alpini hat with an eagle feather in it, and a hole in front you couldn't put your little finger in, and a hole in back you could put your fist in, if it were a small fist and you wanted to put it there, and much blood in the snow. He was a damned fine general, and so was General von Baer, who commanded the Bavarian Alpenkorps troops at the Battle of Caporetto and was killed in his staff car by the Italian rear guard as he drove into Udine ahead of his troops. And the titles of all such books should be Generals Usually Die in Bed, if we are to have any sort of accuracy in such things. Old Lady: when does the story start? Author: now, madam, at once, you'll soon have it. In the mountains, too, sometimes, the snow fell on the dead outside the dressing station, on the side that was protected by the mountain from any shelling. They carried them into a cave that had been dug into the mountainside before the earth froze. It was in this cave that a man, whose head was broken as a flower pot may be broken, although it was all held together by membranes in a skillfully applied bandage now soaked and hardened, with the structure of his brain disturbed by a piece of broken steel in it, lay a day, a night, and a day. The stretcher-bearers asked the doctors to go in and have a look at him. They saw him each time they made a trip, and even when they did not look at him, they heard him breathing. The doctor's eyes were red, and the lid swollen almost shut from tear gas. He looked at the man twice, once in daylight, once with a flashlight. That too would have made a good etching for Goya, the visit with the flashlight, I mean. After looking at him the second time, the doctor believed the stretcher bearers when they said the soldier was still alive.
"What do you want me to do about it?" he asked.
There was nothing they wanted done. But after a while, they asked permission to carry him out and lay him with the badly wounded.
"No, no, no," said the doctor, who was busy. "What's the matter? Are you afraid of him?" "We don't like to hear him in there with the dead." "Don't listen to him. If you take him out of there, you will have to carry him right back in." "We wouldn't mind that, Captain Doctor." "No," said the doctor, "no. Didn't you hear me say no?"
"Why don't you give him an overdose of morphine?"
asked an artillery officer who was waiting to have a wound in his arm dressed.
"Do you think that is the only use I have for morphine? Would you like me to have to operate without morphine? You have a pistol, go out and shoot him yourself."
"He's been shot already," said the officer. "If some of you doctors were shot, you'd be different."
"Thank you very much," said the doctor, waving forceps in the air. "Thank you 1,000 times. What about these eyes?"
He pointed the forceps at them.
"How would you like these?"
"Tear gas. We call it lucky if it's tear gas."
"Because you leave the line," said the doctor. "Because you come running here with your tear gas to be evacuated. You rub onions in your eyes."
"You are beside yourself. I do not notice your insults. You are crazy."
The stretcher-bearers came in.
"Captain Doctor," one of them said. "Get out of here," said the doctor.
They went out.
"I will shoot the poor fellow," the artillery officer said. "I am a humane man. I will not let him suffer."
"Shoot him then," said the doctor. "Shoot him. Assume the responsibility. I will make a report. Wounded, shot by Lieutenant of Artillery in First Curing Post. Shoot him. Go ahead, shoot him." "You are not a human being. My business is to care for the wounded, not to kill them.
That is for gentlemen of the artillery. Why don't you care for him then? I have done so. I have done all that can be done. Why don't you send him down on the cable railway?
Who are you to ask me questions? Are you my superior officer? Are you in command of this dressing post? Do me the courtesy to answer.
The lieutenant of artillery said nothing. The others in the room were all soldiers, and there were no other officers present.
Answer me, said the doctor, holding a needle up in his forceps. Give me a response.
Fuck yourself, said the artillery officer.
So, said the doctor, so you said that. All right, we shall see.
The lieutenant of artillery stood up and walked toward him.
Fuck yourself, he said. Fuck yourself, fuck your mother, fuck your sister.
The doctor tossed the saucer full of iodine in his face. As he came toward him, blinded, the lieutenant fumbled for his pistol. The doctor skipped quickly behind him, tripped him, and as he fell to the floor, kicked him several times and picked up the pistol in his rubber gloves. The lieutenant sat on the floor, holding his good hand to his eyes.
I'll kill you, he said. I'll kill you as soon as I can see.
I am the boss, said the doctor. All is forgiven since you know I am the boss. You cannot kill me because I have your pistol. Sergeant! Adjutant! Adjutant!
The adjutant is at the cable railway, said the sergeant.
Wipe out this officer's eyes with alcohol and water. He has got iodine in them. Bring me the basin to wash my hands. I will take this officer next.
You won't touch me.
Hold him tight. He's a little delirious.
One of the stretcher bearers came in.
Captain Doctor.
What do you want?
The man in the dead house.
Get out of here.
Is dead, Captain Doctor. I thought you would be glad to know.
See, my poor lieutenant, we dispute about nothing. In time of war, we dispute about nothing.
Fuck you, said the lieutenant of artillery. He still could not see.
You blinded me.
It is nothing, said the doctor.
Your eyes will be all right. This is nothing. A dispute about nothing.
I, suddenly screamed the lieutenant.
You have blinded me, you have blinded me!
Hold him tight, said the doctor. He's in a much pain. Hold him very tight.
Old lady, is that the end? I thought you said it was like John Greenleaf Whittier's Snowbound.
Madam, I'm wrong again. We aim so high and yet we miss the target. Old lady.
You know I like you less and less the more I know you.
Madam, it is always a mistake to know an author.